Good afternoon. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Kathleen Dunn Show today on the Ideas Network. Well, beside the election of Donald Trump and a wave of Republicans on November 8th, there's another big story that emerged from Election Day in America. Marijuana had a big, big day. Marijuana-related legislation, legalization measures, rather, were on the ballot in 9 states earlier this month, 4 related to medical marijuana, 5 to recreational. 8 of them passed. We're going to talk about what that means. While efforts to legalize marijuana on a statewide level appear to be gaining steam, federal law hasn't budged, and cannabis remains a prohibited Schedule I drug. This hour, we'll look at where we stand on marijuana policy and the law in the United States, changing attitudes towards pot, and how new research into the drug might shape policy going forward. We, of course, want to know what you think about all of this. Here's how you can get involved. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's a different number than the one you're used to using for Kathleen Dunn's show. 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. My guest is Sam Mendez, Executive Director of the Cannabis Law and Policy Project at the University of Washington School of Law. Sam, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, as regards marijuana policy, what really happened on Election Day? How are things different now than they were before November 8th?
Yeah, well, as you had just stated, it was actually a very big day for cannabis legalization. It was sort of overshadowed by the presidential results. But we had 9 states considering different forms of legalization, 5 of which you might call adult use, or some also call it recreational legalization systems, and another 4 specifically for medical cannabis laws. There's a number of firsts here with this election season. California, I would say, is by far the largest story here, just given that they're the 6th largest economy in the world, and vast majority of cannabis grown in the United States is there. So just by the sheer size, and also their California tends to be sort of a policy bellwether, you know, where they lead the way with things, you know, such as environmental regulation back in the 1970s, and that pushes the rest of the country to go a certain way. You know, other interesting, factoids here was Nevada, which is, you know, more conservative than the West Coast states like Oregon and Washington that legalized. They approved that initiative. And then also the first states on the East Coast to approve cannabis legalizations, and that was in Maine and Massachusetts. I find Maine was very interesting in just how close it was. It was just within a couple of thousand votes, and they did not call it until a week after the election. And then Massachusetts is also interesting, where despite being such a liberal state, you had, I would say, pretty much the entire political establishment there lined up against the initiative. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they're all Democrats. So you had the governor and the attorney general saying, don't vote for this. And the public voted for it anyway, and by a large margin.
Yeah, I remember reading something about that. Of course, the major pharmaceutical companies are not happy about anything that would legalize marijuana, because they lose money when people use pot. So we saw that happen particularly in Arizona, where there was an enormous amount of money spent opposing their pot referendum, which failed. But in Massachusetts, right, there was some other stuff going on. There were people who were concerned that the way the question was worded was flawed. Wasn't that what was going on in Massachusetts? I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this, but I think there was something about that. It was more of a kind of a legal / policy opposition, not a general, we're not opposed to pot, but this is a bad piece of legislation.
Well, you know, I'm not sure exactly the specifics that you're referring to, but there is. You know, I'd say there are hiccups with the initiative system, and just by the nature of the system, you can write a proposal that would then be voted on by the entire state if you can get enough signatures, and that's, it's not always a well-written law. So from what I've seen with Massachusetts, I think it's it seems to hew pretty similar to other state laws in that it allows home grow, meaning that residents are allowed to grow up to six plants within their home. It taxes the regulated system. It allows the purchase and possession of cannabis for adults 21 and over. So I haven't seen anything yet that really stands out to me. But just as an example of the initiative process, you might say, gone wrong, and that could actually be debated. But in Ohio, a couple of years back, they did have a legalization initiative that was really just written by a couple of wealthy business executives, and it stated in the law that the system would be initially restricted to only about 10 or so businesses. So they were essentially created this ballot to have a monopoly on the entire economy. And this is, you know, we're talking about an economy worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And the voters in Ohio voted that down. It was a very resounding no. So, you know, with the initiative process is, you know, it's got its advantages and its disadvantages. Up to date, the only it's been the only avenue for states to legalize cannabis. It's all been by voters. We've not had a legislature yet legalize cannabis. Vermont came close to doing it, but they haven't yet done it there. You know, I would say the disadvantage with the initiative process, you know, you can see the advantage there, at least for proponents, in that you can sort of bypass the legislature there. Disadvantage is that it's these laws aren't they're not sort of examined and re-examined in the same rigorous process as it is in the legislature, you know, where it goes into a committee and then it's revised and it goes out. And, you know, there are often amendments passed along. So, you know, you'd say if you'd compare it to, a homework assignment or something, you have just many more drafts going through the legislature than you would the initiative process.
Well, and usually there's some sort of legislative research arm, a nonpartisan, that examines proposed bills and does economic impact studies and all sorts of
right.
other things that you don't necessarily get, two guys sitting in a local saloon writing a referendum question on a cocktail napkin, which is not how referendum questions are written. I don't mean to characterize them that way, but there's a vast difference between how they're operating. Well, let's get
sure.
back to kind of the bigger picture here. So we had this kind of wave in this election cycle of approval for either a recreational or medical marijuana use. And let's be honest here, the states where medical marijuana is legal, there are quite a few prescriptions, I think, that go out that are more recreational than medical, but at least from what I hear from friends who live in those states. Why do you think voters have so overwhelmingly supported making marijuana legal in this past election cycle? What was behind that? What's going on?
Sure. Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things going on. First, I just want to address the concern around medical cannabis systems. There's a number of issues going on there. I think, for one, Western medicine simply hasn't caught up just yet. So there, a lot of the medicinal value of cannabis is still debated. And, of course, under federal law, marijuana is still classified as a Schedule I narcotic. So very quickly, what that means is that by law, it is understood by Congress and the Drug Enforcement Agency that it has a high potential for abuse, a lack of accepted safety in any setting, particularly in medical settings, and it does not have any medicinal value. Being on Schedule II still maintains that it has a high potential for abuse, but that it has accepted medicinal value. So you might be surprised to learn that cocaine and methamphetamine are both on Schedule II, so they are actually less heavily regulated than marijuana is. And I find that fascinating because marijuana, of course, there's nothing new about this substance. So you would have thought, just from a scientific standpoint, that there would have been, you know, research going into it, you know, over the last many decades to explore the possibilities of it reinvigorating one's appetite or stopping the growth and sometimes at some places even reducing the size of certain types of tumors such as glioblastoma. So there actually is some research out there showing some of these that I just brought up, as well as, another popular example is Dravet syndrome, which is a type of epilepsy. So, but it's still being debated. So when people say that they, you know, they have medical reasons for pot, that's a, it's a sticky subject. The second point I just want to make on that is that different states have different regulated systems. So California, up until now that's adult use legal, you know, they were the first to have a medical system, and it's been around for 20 years. Very, very liberal. So it's very easy to get a card. And so I think it is a little bit more fair to say that there are people that would get a card for recreational uses there, meaning that they just want to smoke pot. But if you go to other states that have medical systems, such as New York or Illinois, they are very tightly regulated. You can only get a card to obtain medical cannabis if you have one of the listed you know, maladies. So if you have AIDS or if you have certain types of cancer, then you'll be allowed that. But if you do not have any of those diseases, then you will, you know, you're not allowed within that system. So different states have, you know, regulate it more tightly than others.
And that's a familiar problem when regulation of something like this it happens at the state level, because each state has its own culture and its own way of doing things, and so you get this
right.
Patchwork of regulations which vary from place to place.
Right, right. And so that sort of segues into your next question about, you know, what's going on here. I think we're really seeing a cultural shift away from the war on drugs. And there's, you know, again, a lot of different facets you could examine there, whether you're looking at criminal justice or the actual danger of different types of drugs, comparing it to alcohol. But you're seeing the general public, and that is a broad generalization, but moving faster than the federal government is moving. So you now have nationally 57% of the American public favors legalizing pot. I think generally you see it being seen as not as dangerous as initially thought. You know, that 57% figure is much higher. You know, 10, 20 years ago, it was, you know, half of that. And in the 70s and 80s, it was hovering between 10 to 20% in favoring legalization. And of course, you had Ronald Reagan quoting in the early 80s that marijuana was the most dangerous drug affecting our country. So I think there's sort of been a somewhat of a rebuke of that. I think also you've seen the ravages of the opioid crisis that we've had across the country, and just how dangerous that has been. And so, you know, you can take that issue and you know, parse it one way or the other. One might say, well, we do have this huge opioid crisis, so why should we allow more access to this type of drug? Shouldn't we be fighting drugs? And then on the other side, you know, proponents argue that while there's a huge difference between cannabis and heroin and methamphetamine, and it's important that we examine each drug separately to see their actual slated danger. And I think, I do think personally, I think there's a far more similarities between cannabis and alcohol, at least compared to cannabis and heroin. Just in terms of the, you know, there is scientific evidence on the addictiveness, and it's shown that cannabis is not as addictive as heroin. It does not really induce overdoses, meaning you basically cannot die from marijuana alone. So I think you just see across the country, people are examining it a little bit more critically. And then state governments as well are now being interested in, as well as another avenue to generate tax revenue. And it has generated mm-hmm. lots of tax revenue in Washington and Colorado. So there's that aspect as well.
We're about at a break here, so I think we'll take a break. When we come back, we do have people on the phone who want to join us. There's still a line open for you if you would care to be part of the Kathleen Dunn Show today, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and join us that way. What do you think about all of this? There seems to be a groundswell of support for the legalization of marijuana. Not too popular at the federal level. The DEA still has marijuana listed as one of the as a Schedule I drug among the most dangerous. And we're just kind of examining that kind of dichotomy, I guess you could call it. Sam Mendez is my guest. He's executive director of the Cannabis Law and Policy Project at the University of Washington School of Law. Sam, when we come back, and just before we go to the phones, I do want to, there's one more thing I really want to cover here, that the significance of the California vote, and you did mention they're the world's sixth largest economy, but what does that mean really for the rest of us? And is that kind of you said they were kind of a bellwether? Well, what's going to happen next based on what happened out in California? We'll talk about that, and we'll take your phone calls in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR.
Don't bogart that joint, my friend. Pass it over.
Marijuana initiatives passed in a bushel of states in the most recent election, and now a majority of states either have legalized medical marijuana or recreational use. We're talking about what this groundswell of support for the legalization of pot means here in the United States, with Sam Mendez, executive director of the Cannabis Law and Policy Project at the University of Washington School of Law. Of course, Washington, one of the states that has legalized recreational marijuana. One big state that did it is California. This is one of the big stories out there. They voted to legalize recreational marijuana. They had medical marijuana for years. They are the biggest state, and this is a big deal. So, Sam, again, what does it mean that California went for this, and do you think that's going to push other states to follow suit?
Yeah, well, I think the momentum would be heading towards legalization, whether or not California had legalized. But the fact that they did go legal just makes that momentum all the stronger. But it is a very interesting dichotomy that happened on the same day that Donald Trump was elected president. And with him, that there's just a huge question mark as to how the federal government is going to approach this at this point. Who is he going to appoint as attorney general? Because with a flick of a pen, they could shut down every legal system across the country. And by that, it's just state legal, because it's still illegal under federal law. So we are entirely beholden to the federal government. They can basically do as they please, at least from a legal standpoint. But practically and politically, I don't expect them to shut everything down, because they would be picking a huge battle. Because now not only do you have advocates legalizing or advocating for legal pot, but you also have state governments that are now getting literally hundreds of millions of dollars in excise taxes, and they don't really want to lose that tax revenue. I also don't think it's something that President Trump, frankly, cares that much about. He has other fish to fry. But what does it mean? Well, I do think you're going to see more and more states vote on this question. And I actually think it's a good thing that this is being done at the state level. I don't think the whole country is ready for legal pot across, nationwide. And you still do see differences of opinion. I mean, even here in Washington State, we are known as a very liberal blue state. Initiative 502, which legalized pot in 2012, it passed by about 55%. So that means that 45% of voters voted against this. So you still see pretty strong differences between a political line. So it's those in favor of legalization is much stronger among Democrats compared to Republicans. And interestingly, it's also much stronger among millennials compared to baby boomers and the older generations. So it's interesting to see how where legalization is supported and where it isn't. Mm-hmm. But California is a signal that, that it's not going anywhere. That the largest state by economy and by population is now implementing a regulatory system here. So what we can expect, nobody can really predict the future and what's going to happen at the federal level. But it becomes more and more entrenched as time goes on. The federal government would have to be picking a bigger fight to actually try to shut it down. And I think we can expect to see some movement at the federal level within the next few years. Who knows? You know, two, mm-hmm. three, 5 years about seeing whether cannabis would be rescheduled to Schedule II or descheduled. Or, you know, there's other sort of legal ideas around, you know, exempting marijuana from control.
And there's some tax issues and some banking issues that I want to get to that are concerned with the business of pot. But we have full phone lines. And since this is a call-in talk show, I probably should take some calls. Plus, I want to take some calls, so let's take a call. We'll start in Milwaukee, where Jim has been patiently waiting. Jim, thanks for joining us on the Kathleen Dunn Show today.
Well, thanks, and this is a great topic, and I'm all for legalization and greater dialogue everywhere toward that end. And I agree also that we need to reduce the burden on our federal prisons. Our country has 5% of the world's population, yet we have 20% of the incarcerated, and these people in the prisons are there because we have a crazy system that guarantees occupancy under a privatized system. Also, the Hispanic and Black as a population represent the majority of inmates. And I feel that this, in other words, shows an element of discrimination that simply is wrong. And my final point would be that we need to change federal guidelines and use common sense with legalization.
Jim, thanks for the call. Sam, a lot of points to go through there. Clearly, the point about the mass incarceration that we have here, a lot of it tied to the war on drugs, clearly a big issue for proponents of legal marijuana.
Indeed. Yeah, thanks, Jim. He mentioned a couple of issues there. Indeed, incarceration has skyrocketed in the last 30 or 40 years. A lot of that has been related to, quote, tough on crime laws and to approaches towards drug policy and how we treat those who are addicted to drugs and those who use drugs. The other big issue there is the racial justice and the racial inequities we have here around this issue. The ACLU published a report that showed that while use of cannabis was the same among Black people and white people, Black people were twice as likely to be arrested for that, for smoking pot. And so, you know, there's just issues around there around how, the inequality of how they are treated under the law. So mm-hmm. it is certainly an ongoing issue. And then there's, you know, even within the regulated system of cannabis, there's often debates about how do you include people of color into the industry, because we're finding now that it is being heavily dominated by white people.
Big corporations are getting into this, too. I mean, we're not talking about a lot of small farm, individual grower kind of things. These are, you know, we're starting to see large scale, almost industrial cannabis operations in some of the states where it's become legal. Aren't we seeing that?
To a certain extent. I mean, I think that, you know, there's often the talk about the specter of, quote, big marijuana. And I do think over the long term, if this trend continues, that is inevitable. That's simply just how I think how capitalism works, for better or for worse. You know, if you look at the alcohol industry of Anheuser-Busch and these massive beer companies, I do think it's headed in that direction. But it has been slowed by some of the banking and tax issues that you briefly mentioned.
Let's take a moment and talk about that, because that's really a big deal. I mean, that seems to be one of the things that really holds back this business. As I understand it, dealers can't use banks because of federal law. And even if marijuana was a Schedule II drug, there would still be significant IRS barriers. So let's talk about that. First of all, basically marijuana right now is a cash business.
Right, right.
And that's
now,
a problem.
Keep in mind that there are some credit unions do take business accounts now. So here in Washington State, most cannabis businesses that I've interacted with do have bank accounts, but they're at local credit unions and not, you know, Bank of America or Chase.
Well, but they can't take credit cards.
Right. No, they cannot. Yeah, so anybody purchasing pot has to do so with cash, and that it creates huge security issues as well as transactional and business issues. Because the businesses have had to resort to very creative ways to moving cash around because they're a target for burglaries, and stores have been burglarized here in Washington State. So it's a security issue as well as a financial one.
Mm-hmm. And what about the tax issues?
Right. So the issue you brought up around taxes and the Controlled Substances Act. So it's well known in the industry, but not so well known outside of it. It's called 280E, and it's a tax provision that, as I've heard, it was passed in the early 80s by Congress due to a drug lord who sold all sorts of drugs, heroin and cocaine, et cetera, who was making business deductions for his yachts and his luxury sports cars, et cetera. So they passed this law that said if you are engaged in an illegal business in the trafficking of a Schedule One or Schedule Two drug, then you will not be able to make normal business deductions for that business. So it's important to note there that even if marijuana is rescheduled to Schedule Two, it will not change that by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so for now, you have all these businesses that maybe they may be taking in millions of dollars in revenue, but because they can't deduct the miles on their car or their payroll or other normal deductions that any other business would make, their profit margin is very, very low, and a lot of that revenue just goes straight to the IRS.
Well, so, and they're more than willing to take it, even as the federal government says marijuana is illegal. That's always a little bit of a poser for some. Let's take another call. Dennis is with us, who's an over-the-road trucker who's in Wisconsin. Dennis, hello.
Hey. Yeah, I'm an over-the-road trucker, and going through some of those states, how is it going to work with being legalized but being able to drive?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. The two greatest concerns, nationally around cannabis legalization are two things. One, what about drugs driving? And two, what about access to children? So on the question of driving, it is a concern. I would say that it's a concern that existed before it was legal as well. Of course, you should not when you are intoxicated with any substance, whether it's alcohol, cannabis, or any other illegal substance.
Or Ambien,
Indeed. The data shown so far has shown that there's not been a huge uptick in driving. I'm looking here at some information provided by the Drug Policy Alliance that in Colorado and Washington, we've had legal systems the longest. There's not been a huge uptick in drugs driving. There's also some concern around the data itself and whether this was even tracked as closely as it has been now. So, of course, it's being examined much at a much higher rate than it was before. But there's also plenty of issues around how do you actually, how do police deal with somebody that is intoxicated? We've attempted to create a bright line rule, much like alcohol, where you have the 0.08 blood alcohol content. And we've tried to do the same with cannabis. But it's more complicated. We've had this 5 nanograms of THC in your blood, which is A, more difficult to do because it requires an actual blood test, and B, has actually been questioned. There's a AAA study that showed that there was actually no scientific merit to the 5 nanogram level at all. So you could be beyond that level and still be totally fine to drive. You could be below that level and not be okay to drive. It just depends on your tolerance level. So my editorial there is that I'm skeptical of bright line levels because we don't have one for Ambien, as you brought up, or other pharmaceutical legal drugs out there. It's all based on the police officer's perception of intoxication. So I think we should be aiming more at that level. What blood alcohol content really does is that it's not so much protecting the driver, but it provides the police with sort of an ace in the hole in terms of evidence, where if you're above that, you've broken the law, simple as that. It's very difficult to dispute that.
It's what a friend of mine used to call a lawyer law. It's what a friend of mine used to call a lawyer law.
Right.
Yeah, kind of like, well, never mind. Dennis, thanks for that call. We'll go to Crandon next, and Kevin is on the line. Kevin, good afternoon. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hello. I think marijuana should just be legalized. Let's just get over this. According to Kyle,
I have you. I've heard it said a few times that now the majority of the states, actually, I believe it's quite a bit more. If my count is correct, now we have 32 states in the District of Columbia that have legalized it either medically or recreationally. So that's, and I happen to live here in Wisconsin, which is one of the 12 that haven't. We have a very serious drinking problem here in Wisconsin, which I would appreciate if John would back me up on that. We have people here in Wisconsin that are getting their, still getting their 7th, 8th, 10th drunk driving, and yet somebody caught with a small bit of marijuana, particularly up here, and they're still fighting the drug war heavy here in northern Wisconsin that are made into full-blown criminals for having some pot, you know, having to go to jail, go to court, get fined, get it on your record and all that. And I don't think it's right. And it's just time to for people to get over it.
Okay, Kevin, we got it. And yes, Wisconsin does have a well-earned reputation as being a haven for binge drinking. And some places, the joke is we're better than AT&T. We have more bars in more places. So thanks for that, Kevin. Sam, anything you want to chew on there?
Not too much. I think, you know, certainly there you have the opinions in favor of legalization. You know, I would just echo what I said earlier, that it's not universal, and we should keep in mind that there's still a very significant subset in the country that is against it. You know, and I won't, you know, question who is right and who is wrong. You know, of course, I have my own political beliefs around the subject. But I also bring up that this, while the United States is very much a pioneer here internationally, Canada is committed to legalizing cannabis next year. They'll be the essentially the very first country in the world to have a regulated and taxed system that involves businesses. You know, other states or other countries have done so, but in a different manner. So, and in other countries, you have other arguments being made as well. So, you know, in Mexico, there's been a debate around it as well, but there it's much more about human rights and less so about taxes. You know, here in the United States, it's often seen as a business potential. In other countries, much less so. So it's happening internationally as well.
And I know that one of the points that was being made, at least in the Arizona referendum campaign, was that this would strike a blow against the Mexican drug cartels because it would hit them in the pocketbook. That gets brought up from time to time. What about the war on drugs? Is it time to just say we lost and move on? Is that what is that what people are saying these days? Hey, this is over. We clearly didn't win the war, and it's time to stop throwing money at it.
Right. Well, I do think it's definitely fair to say that we have not won the war on drugs. You know, we have spent billions and arguably trillions over the last 30 some odd years against fighting drug use, and drug use is as high as ever. And meanwhile, you know, at least from a scientific standpoint, alcohol is a drug as well. You know, we did have an experiment in prohibition of alcohol back in the 1920s. It didn't work out so well. But the question there then is that, you know, what do you legalize and what do you keep illegal? You know, some, particularly in the libertarian space, will say we should just legalize all drugs. Personally, I don't think that's a good idea. I think there's a lot of risks associated with that. So I think what we should be doing, you know, the war on drugs is sort of this amorphous concept, and there's all sorts of issues within that that you could examine. But I do think that as a country, we should be examining different drugs at different levels and understand that there's a very important distinction between alcohol and cannabis. They have different effects on the body, and between alcohol, cannabis, and heroin. Some of these are far more addictive and can actually kill you with a very small amount, while others cannot. So I do think that whether or not the whole country legalizes or different states legalize, we should at least examine different drugs and come to different policy solutions based on those conclusions.
We're at another break. I need to we need to take a break and check on a couple of things. And when we come back, Sam, I want to hear, this is very intriguing, I want to hear about cooperative federalism as a possible alternative to rescheduling marijuana. And we still have full phone banks, and we want to get to as many calls as we can before the end of the hour. Sam Mendez is my guest. We're talking about the results of the last election, not at the presidential level, but at the state level, where a number of states voted to legalize cannabis, either for medical purposes or recreational, and what that might mean heading toward possibly seeing it legal all across the United States. Sam Mendez is executive director of the Cannabis Law and Policy Project at the University of Washington School of Law. 800-642-1234, the number to call. We'll make room for you if we can. So give us a call and join the program. If the line is busy, send us an email, talk@WPR.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We're talking about marijuana this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. A wave of states legalized marijuana use in one form or another in the most recent round of elections. A lot of state referenda on the ballots across the country, and only one of them failed. The rest all passed, including in some places where you might not expect to see a marijuana legalization referendum pass. Some fairly conservative states did that. And we're wondering what that means going forward, possibly toward legalization across the country. Sam Mendez is my guest. He is the executive director of the Cannabis Law and Policy Project at the University of Washington School of Law. Before we go back to the phones, you wrote about a possible alternative to rescheduling marijuana as a drug, something called cooperative federalism. If you could briefly tell us what that is and how likely it would be that this might actually happen, and then we'll go back to the phones and take some more calls.
Sure, yeah. So this was put forth by famed legal scholar Erwin Chemerinsky and a couple of other authors as well, Sam Kamen out of Colorado, who, you know, examined this, encouraged the federal government to cooperate with the states that have legalized cannabis. It's an article that came out a couple of years ago. And they tackled the question of what to do at the federal level, seeing that rescheduling cannabis to Schedule II still does not solve many of the issues as we had already talked about, and that still actually, if it's at Schedule II, that means that it's still a highly regulated medicine, and that does not actually legalize any of the adult use recreational systems you have across the country. And at the same time, any reform at the federal level is going to take a huge amount of political will in Congress, and it's something that is just very, you know, is that actually going to happen? You know, Congress hasn't been known for doing a whole lot in the last few years. So there's the question of rescheduling it. A lot of advocates argue for descheduling it, meaning just take it completely off the Controlled Substances Act and treat it the same way as tobacco and alcohol are treated, both of which are, arguably dangerous substances, especially when used in excess, neither of which are on the Controlled Substances Act. So Chemerinsky suggested, the concept of cooperative federalism and the idea that, you know, Congress could pass a law where rather than having to reform the Controlled Substances Act in the sense of rescheduling, it could provide an exemption. So, for example, where states that have adult use systems like Washington or California, marijuana could be exempted from the Controlled Substances Act in states that have well-regulated systems. So that would then essentially allow a lot of the issues around banking and taxing to be alleviated without having to, reform the entire act itself. So that's it in a nutshell.
Okay, well, and how likely do you think it is that we would actually see that happen?
It's hard to say. Again, okay. It's just a question of Congress moving on it. At this time, I don't think there's really going to be any movement for a couple of years. I do think there's still potential of it happening within the DEA and the Department of Justice. I would never bet on Congress, making such a landmark reform.
I mean, here's a quote from Jeff Sessions, senator from Alabama, who President-elect Trump has tapped to be the next attorney general. At a Senate hearing earlier this year, he said, among other things, "We need grown-ups in Washington to say marijuana is not the kind of thing that ought to be legalized. it ought not to be minimized, that it is, in fact, a very real danger. So, I mean, that's when the head of law enforcement for the federal government says stuff like that, it kind of makes you wonder what's really going to happen going forward. Let's say we've got a whole bunch of people who want to talk about this issue on the phone with us. We'll go to Milwaukee and start with Ray. Ray, hello. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hi to you and your guest. I've been using marijuana for over 40 years. And about 20 years ago, I drove truck and also the band limousine for two rather big bands out of Milwaukee for 6 years from one end of this country to the other. And every time I was driving, I was under the influence. Now, you just brought up how do we test people to see if they have marijuana in their system while driving. It's a very easy test. It's called the field sobriety test. Can you walk the white line? Can you touch your fingers to your nose? And are you weaving in traffic? I think my experience, at least for me, marijuana had zero effect on my ability to drive, and I smoked some very, very, very good pot back 20-some years ago. It was still coming from Colombia and Mexico. I don't really care a whole lot about today's pot, which is indoor grown, and it's totally, it's a different thing altogether to me in some ways. But if the medical community wants to look for long-term effects, why don't they go to India, where the people there, and their part of their religion is to grow good marijuana. They've been using it for 2,000 years in India, and Big Pharma does not want pot legalized because they make the substance, it's called Marinol, and it's their version of the THC, but it's not even synthesized from marijuana plant. It is synthesized from petrochemicals, and that is probably the number one reason in this country why we still are so backwards. I mean, the federal government working against us.
Ray, we're running out of time. I want to have Sam's response, and then I want to move to another caller, but thanks for that call, Ray. What about a Big Pharma doesn't like marijuana? They've got their own version.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the question of Big Pharma and big marijuana are really interesting things to think about. I think it's important to note that, you know, there were a lot of people, you know, you might say within the marijuana sphere in California who were against the initiative that legalized pot there because they didn't want it to become a huge, you know, corporate substance. And they liked it sort of being a cottage industry, even if it was technically illegal there. And also a lot of people, particularly in Northern California, stand to take a big hit from their local economy because when you have an illegal substance and sort of have a somewhat of a monopoly on it, once you legalize it, you're now people are buying land up all across the state and it's going to become much more competitive. So, you know, even those within, you know, the business, if you will, and patients, et cetera, they're not all uniform in their thoughts around the issue. You know, again, back to the issue of driving, you know, I encourage everybody to not drive when they are under the influence of any substance. But again, you know, you can point to the data here that shows that traffic fatalities, for example, here in reported in Colorado have gone down between 2006 and 2014. And that's those are figures coming from the state of Colorado itself. So. Mm-hmm. Even in states that have legalized cannabis, you haven't seen an uptick or more people dying from vehicular crashes.
All right, Ray, thanks for the call. We'll go to Elizabeth in Fish Creek next. Elizabeth, hello. Welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hi there. Two things. First, CBD. I'm a product formulator, and I do private label of herbal blends that include CBD. And, you know, our CBD is allowed for, it's non-psychoactive. It's for national distribution, but we have to get it from hemp that is grown overseas. And yet we still have a lot of difficulty with my clients have a lot of difficulty with the credit card processing. The FDA seems really confused. I'm wondering if there's any forward motion there. And second of all, when we talk about the issue of big business, and I think that Washington State has the best legislation. It's my favorite. I love the lengths that you have gone to try to make sure that you really keep big business to a minimum, keeping it in state. And it's one of the reasons why I'm hoping Wisconsin will use Washington as a model. I love cooperative federalism. I think that the big reason for doing it is to really try to keep autonomy state by state, seed to sale, which keeps cottage industry in each state. And we let each state move forward as the culture is individually ready. And rescheduling runs the risk of having pharmaceuticals completely take over cannabis. I think it's a huge danger, and I would never want to see it. I love the idea of having exemptions and really maintaining cottage industry by, again, seed to sale every state. And what Washington is doing is awesome.
Elizabeth, got to let you go because we got a lot more callers to try to get in about 4 minutes to do it. Elizabeth made a lot of points there. Sam, pick a couple and then let's move on.
Sure, yeah, I'll try to be fast here. So CBD is cannabidiol. It's a compound in cannabis along with THC. So THC is the stuff that gets you stoned or high. And by the way, there are many compounds within cannabis, many of which, you know, terpenes, for example, are really not well understood yet. So it's actually fascinating. There's a gold mine of scientific research there. But CBD has been often quoted as the compound that can combat certain types of epilepsy. And again, it's non-psychoactive. So some people use it. Even children have been known to use it for medical purposes. There's also a number of states, particularly in the Deep South, that do have medical marijuana laws, but specific to CBD. So, you know, you are only allowed to use CBD and not other compounds within the plant. I just want to make one last point around the question of the pharmaceutical companies. I think it's fascinating in the sense that generally now they are fully against it. There have been studies that shown that in states that have medical marijuana programs, levels of opioid addiction and abuse have actually gone down. So there is a link there. But I do think that as you see more and more states legalize, and if there is movement at the federal level, frankly, I think that the pharmaceutical industry is going to then move in and cash in. You know, they're known for selling, selling billions of dollars worth of medicine. And if marijuana is seen at some point as a medicine, well, why would they not take that up?
Right. Let's try and get one more call in here. Jade is with us. And Jade, I'm going to ask you to be very brief because we're almost out of time, but we'll take Jade next. Hi, Jade.
Hi, how are you guys? Thank you for taking my call. I was a professional grower for many years in Colorado before the industry hit recreational when we were still medical. And I'll be honest with you, through growing, helping so many people with so many different ailments, from cancers, HIV and AIDS, people that are severely suffering. What I'd like to bring up, including personal family, my father is a two-time leukemia survivor and a cannabis user. And what I'd like to suggest is that we have a larger conversation in the country that has been going on for way too long. Everyone knows that cannabis is medicine. The varying degrees of how that shows up, whether it's synthesized or whether it's concentrated or whether you're just harvesting flowers, it's natural. It's been one of the top medicines on the globe for thousands of years. And that's it. And it's like, what's the big deal? That's my question. And
All right. Jade, we'll have to let you go there. Sam, what's the big deal? Let's finish with that. And where do you see this going in about 30 seconds?
Sure. I would just say to all your listeners to stay tuned as we see this story continues. It's far from over. What's the big deal? Well, I don't know exactly how to answer that. I mean, I think there is, again, big differences between opioids and cannabis. So I think we can continue to see a further reexamination. And when you had President Obama state that we should see drug addiction as a medical issue and not a criminal issue, That, at least until the election day with the new president, was a big sign that there's, you know, now seeing a reexamination of how we approach drugs in this country.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much, Sam. Sam Mendez, appreciate your time today. Thanks also to Chris Molina for producing the show and KP Whaley for on-air production. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.